broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
A diver cleared the surface, his black and silver gear glinting in the sunlight as he motioned to the sheriff. The sheriff signaled the operator, and the engine slowed again. The diver disappeared underwater. When he surfaced a second time, he waved to the sheriff. The crane started up again with a lot of noise. The crane gear screamed against the hoist winch. Harry snapped photos, his camera whirring. Parts of an encrusted boat began to appear. Thomas Holliday, in his book, Powerboat Racer. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The program is in two parts today. The first is a discussion with Thomas Holliday about his River Sunday Romance Mystery Series. In the second part of the program, my guests are author and historian Susan Jones and the new president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association and book publisher Ron Souder. Thomas Holliday, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you up here in all this snow in Boston.
That's right, Tommy. You're in Boston, and you've got a lot of snow up there, don't you?
Yes, I'm a real expatriate. I'm like some of those writers used to say, about writers, we live in our dreams. We write books to live in another world.
And to take people to that world, I hope.
I wanted to say the book that you read a quote from was my first novel with child characters. And as I often do in the beginning of chapter, I introduce a lot of the characters that'll ride along through the whole book. And in this case, the wreck was found by two children who were going fishing. One was a little black boy named Weejay, and a little white boy, his pal, named Chucky.
Well, Tommy, before we get into your seven books, I understand from reading about you that you are a real lover of nature and have a great concern for the preservation of nature. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that first?
Well, first of all, when you read my books, different than most writers about regions, I'm a swamp lover. I love the swamps and all the animals they have in them, especially on the shore. We have Blackwater, and I've even gone on special tours down there to see what the muskrat life is like and so forth. I was brought up, my uncle was a local politician, T. Slaughter, and he had a big farm up in Longwoods. And, of course, my father, who was a photographer, loved animals. People used to bring him snakes, and he'd take them out to the country and make sure they were safe. The family's been in farming around animals. And, of course, we grew up fishing and hunting as children. So I sort of carried this nature along. I do it in, of course, my cartoon work. But in my stories, every story has a bird. And it usually has a dog or a cat. And they follow along through the story as important characters.
Well, you grew up, you're in Massachusetts now, but you grew up on the Eastern Shore. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Absolutely. And one of the things about my writing, of course, over the years, I grew up doing small stories and drawing cartoons for my various schools and my friends and so forth. But I always had this sense that the Eastern Shore was something special. Not necessarily because I grew up there and walked the streets and so forth, but because my family had been down there for centuries. And as a child, I heard all the storytellers, my cousins. They'd come by the house. We lived in a white house with big chimneys next to the Safeway. And they'd come by and sit on the porch and tell me stories of what some cousin did somewhere in some adventure. And these stories just piled up. And, of course, they were family stories, but they were something that I wanted to carry along with me. And eventually, I found that, like a lot of regional writers, I could put these stories into books. And that's where River Sunday came from.
What town did you grow up in, Tommy?
I was actually a child in Easton. And I lived between there and my uncle's place in Longwoods. And then there was a family general store in Cordova. And I spent a lot of my time in Oxford sailing boats, and out with my friends and fishing from boats and so forth. I built a boat when I was 14. My father had built boats before then. And cousin Lowndes Johnson, he was a big sailor. He invented the Comet sailboat. So I had a lot of this around me.
Well, there are seven books, as I said, in your River Sunday series. I find this an impressive number of novels, Tommy. And you said that you used to sit around and as a child and listen to stories told by your relatives and your family. How did you come to determine that you wanted to write these stories? What happened in your life that caused you to begin to write them down?
It's a funny thing. When you grow up down there in the country, especially with politicians in your family, you have a choice. Should I be a politician? And then there was a strong influence of the Catholic Church in my life. And my family, half my family were Catholics. And should I go into the religion in some way? And then there was always the idea of business. Go somewhere and make some money, because there's no money here on the shore unless you want to run a gas station. And so I went on into business, but I carried along with me this storytelling, the old gift of gab thing.
What kind of business did you do, Tommy, when you went
into business? I was in international business and traveled all over the world. And, of course, I went to Johns Hopkins to the writing seminars where I first got a taste of what real writing was. And after that, Vietnam, of course, which was something I volunteered for, having a family like my own that had been practically every war this country ever been in, it was kind of a natural thing for me to do. And then I came back and after a stint of working in civil rights in Easton, which I'm not sure was successful or not, but at least I did it for about a year. I went north and got back to get my MBA in business.
When did you decide that you wanted to write novels?
Well, it's a funny thing. It went a long time, because when I was at Hopkins, I'd write novels, but they really weren't novels. In those days, a lot of us tried to copy Faulkner and Hemingway and so forth, and we all tried all kinds of strange new idea fiction and so forth, and most of it was garbage. And it took me a long time to really sit down and talk to people and figure out how to actually put these stories together into something that somebody else could read. I had a good friend from the Atlantic Monthly who helped me a lot in trying to structure these books. And as time went on, I finally got a formula that I could turn out the books. And at that time, I began to spend more time on the themes and the characters. it's kind of, for me, it was kind of a progress of getting the format down and the mechanics down, and then expanding on the thoughts I wanted. Would that have to worry about the characters, the mechanics? A lot of writers, I'm sure, go through this.
Did you have a series in mind when you started? I mean, seven books. I think that's commendable.
Well, I think you're wonderful to say that. I have friends who publish far more than that, but they seem to have the knack of typing them out fast. I'm not really able to do that. But to tell you the honest truth, I decided early on in this that my books would all be about this fictional town called River Sunday. And from that, I decided that the best thing to do was pick things about River Sunday, the real Eastern Shore, that were meaningful to the world, subjects and themes that had some meaning that were not just about this country, but of great significance. And in that way, I thought that River Sunday would be kind of a microcosm, that it would have all these other problems. And so I picked out the problems I would handle in each book. For example, River Sunday, which was my first book, was about freedom. My second book, Magnolia Gods, was about atomic warfare, and so forth, down the list of the books. And, you know, you don't run out of great world themes. You do get, and you don't run out of characters. You do get a little long in the tooth about whether you can write another one or not, but so far I'm steaming along. I'm working on my eighth book now. Meanwhile, of course, having been a cartoonist most of my life, I published two books of cartoons now and have written a very, what I consider an encyclopedic book about water and animals, which is another side of my life. Years ago, I started a company making water products for animals, which has been fairly successful, and that has led to more work in animal care and welfare and so forth.
Does that show up? Does that work show up in your novels, Tom?
Well, I've always said at the back of each of my books that anything I make out of these books, especially the nature books, goes to help animals. So I really didn't start writing these books to make a lot of money. I wrote them because I had a goal in mind, a theme, and something that I wanted to say. And, of course, if I could help animals doing it, every book of mine has either a bird or a dog or a cat as a principal character. I love that. And they also have music, I notice, in most movies, which are the video part of a book, so to speak, that they always have music in these movies. So I try to put a little music, at least quoting a song or something, in each of my books. And that adds to the more modern version of the story.
Well, Tom, Tommy, say a little bit more about the structure of your books, and then perhaps we can talk about one particular book and how that structure fits into that book. But you said structure. You have a major point in each one of the books, like freedom and the atom bomb and so forth. What other kind of structure for your books do you have in mind?
Well, when I was fiddling around with these books and looking at a lot of ways to put them together so they would make some sense, I did think that a lot of really good books had gone on to become screenplays and from thence to become movies. And one of the most important things to me in writing these books, after learning, going through all the Johns Hopkins times of learning to write books and seeing how so many books went off in strange directions where you couldn't really finish the book, it was so complicated, I was anxious to make sure that my books were easy to read and simple in flow and pacing and so forth. Not an easy thing to do, but they would be something that people could follow easily and get the point. And something where they would identify with the characters, that these characters were a lot like them. So I decided to look into screenplays and found out that most of them follow the three-part or three-act concept. So all my books run 24 chapters. The first eight chapters are essentially the first act. The second eight chapters are the second act. And the last three, 17 to 24, are the third act. First chapter is usually an introduction of the characters. Keeping in mind, check off. Don't put in anything, it ain't going to come back. And the last chapter, 24, is a kind of a wrap-up where everybody gets together and smiles at each other and they're happy the bad guys are gone or whatever. And that's the structure. And then I went a step further and decided that each chapter would have scenes and spent a lot of time developing these scenes so they would fit together and actually make a chapter have a beginning and an end. So it, too, had a little climax. And if you go to chapter 8 in my books, as you can see, something that makes you want to go on and read the rest of the book. Something happens. The same thing with chapter 16.
Well, Tom, they are all mysteries. And there's so many other approaches you could have taken. You could have written a psychological novel and so forth. Why mysteries? What led you to write mysteries?
Well, it goes back to the storytelling. I'll tell you the honest to God's truth. It goes back to the storytelling. You start with people sitting around a campfire and somebody comes up with a joke. You wait for the cliffhanger. You wait for the ending. Why do you wait? Because there's something there that interests you. And I began to look at, and I've read a few novels, romances and psychological books and whatever, and they all seem to have something that you're trying to find out by the end of the thing. In my simple country mind, it seemed to me that basically they're all kind of a mystery. And so when I wrote these books, I said the first thing is to get somebody's interest. I always tested these books in a kind of an imaginary way. And those of you down on the shore will understand this. Sitting on the porch on a summer night, watching the fireflies, drinking a beer and talking to your good old boys or gang or family or whatever. If you can't say the story and get some interest, that kind of people are going to tell you pretty quick. They're going to get up and leave the porch. So that was always why these stories had to have some kind of an intrigue or suspense or something.
Well, Tommy, let me ask you to pick one of your books. You talk about telling the story. Pick one of your books and tell us the story of that book. And
well, of course, my first book, which was the hardest to write, God knows how many drafts it went through, how many opinions, was Slave Graves. And Slave Graves is a pretty easy book to figure out. It starts out with the discovery of a wreck. And, of course, the wreck is right smack in the middle of where a lot of financial people want to build a bridge. Why do they want to build the bridge? They want to build it because it goes to where they want to make a condominium that will destroy a home of butterflies. So now you've got a whole bunch of issues, and they're all complicated. And the nature people are furious about the butterfly roost. You know, butterflies fly a certain way down the coast of America, and they only land at certain places. And this, of course, was one of those places. And, of course, money going into condominiums is complicated. One of my first critics says, oh, no, another real estate story. And then, of course, you have the wreck itself. And there's controversy about that. Was it a slave graveyard? Well, there's no proof of that. But a lot of the black community think it was, historically or legendary. And what is the thing they found there? Was it a ship? And what kind of ship? Well, into this comes my favorite kind of character, the stranger coming to the small town, the Western hero, the Western story, and all of our Western movies, the one I love the most. It comes from the Greek plays. It's probably the most popular system of writing a book, a stranger coming to a village and saving people. And so here comes the stranger. And who is the stranger but a totally disillusioned guy, totally, who happens to be making good money. He's got all his problems solved. He's got a beautiful girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. He comes into the small town and sees all the mud and everything else. And really, all he wants to do is get back to town, get away from this mess. That's the story. And then you run on through there.
Well, you're not going to tell us the ending here, because we want people to read this book. But I do want to ask you about your main character, this down and out or kind of a broken, little bit broken kind of guy who comes out of what used to be a successful background and got messed up and now he is pulling himself together in this new environment.
That's another story. That's Powerboat Racer.
Uh-huh.
That's a disgraced newspaper man.
Right.
All of these characters, the main characters in all my books,
yeah,
follow one simple philosophy.
Yeah.
They are a strong person who comes to this place having really no interest except personal survival, whether they're going to recover or whatever from the past doesn't make any difference. They're there. And then they have to make a choice. Do they use their strength to take on some kind of evil, or don't they? Now, of course, in writing fiction, the most wonderful thing to do is have a very strong character, not a He-Man, not a square jaw, whatever, just a strong character who comes in and suddenly, like Errol Flynn, becomes the sheriff. That's the principle of every one of my books.
Well, there's romance. It's called a romance series as well. How does the romance with this main character play out? And does it play out in all seven of the books?
Does. And it's fascinating how it does, because you have to figure out why real romance happens. Real romance is based upon equality of the man and the woman. It has to be. And so all my characters start out as strong people, independent, and when they meet, it's because they work on some kind of a mystery as a team. The teamwork leads to the romance. The equality leads to the romance. And the chit-chat back and forth, all the scenes of the two, the man and the woman, add to the story. I have controversy all the time with my friends who write romances. And, of course, I love the Maryland writer. What's her name? I've read all her books. I don't know whether she's that popular. You know who I'm thinking of? The romance writer. Anyway, all these books, basically, they start out with some kind of a controversy between the man and the woman, a developing equality, and almost always a solution of the mystery. All I'm doing is turning it around a little.
Is the main character always a man? I've read two of your books, and in those two, the main character is a man.
I could never write a woman main character. just not capable. However, I feel like from my critics that I can write a team character who is a woman and write her fairly correctly. Whether I could turn that around or not, I've often thought, could I have the main character be a woman and have the team person be a man? Just haven't come up with the right story for that. But my team players are quite equal. They both add to the story.
Tommy,
there's no dominance of the man over the woman and vice versa.
Tommy, you have fight scenes in at least the books that that I've read, and you mentioned earlier Vietnam. And in Powerboat Racer, you also mention Africa. And I'm assuming you're referring to some of the revolutions taking place in Africa. What did you do, as an example, in Vietnam that helps you write these novels?
Well, I was in a very strange situation in Vietnam in that I was a counterintelligence agent living in civilian clothes.
And what does that mean, Tommy?
Well, I basically work with the local people. And so I was always aware that even though I carried a small revolver, that I was essentially a non-combatant. And my situations were always close to terror, but not so close. And I had more of a situation of having my friends be blown up by satchel charges because they went to the wrong place. We were quite out and involved. I was there during the Tet invasion and spent a lot of time having fires and rounds come at me. But I wasn't in the trenches as a combat soldier. As a result, I saw a lot more of the nastiness of the enemy.
How does this experience play out in your novels?
Well, I don't know. I usually have a character who has in some way been influenced by Vietnam. The character in Slave Graves certainly was. He was very disappointed, very disillusioned. Because all of his friends were blown up by a child. But he had to overcome this disillusionment in the story, because if he'd gone on putting it off and just making out for himself, which he did, when it came down to this archaeological project, it was so much of a mess, so much evil, that he had to say, well, I was disappointed last time, but maybe I should open up and try again. And that's, of course, his. So in a way, that's how Vietnam bothered him, but in a way gave him strength to go ahead and try again. That's the point of the book.
Tommy, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, are you trying or are you interested in making a point with your books? And if so, how would you summarize the point that you're trying to make?
Well, I was taught to always look at both sides. And I've always believed that. And in my books, when possible, I try to look at both sides of a problem from the different characters. To me, if I write a book only showing one side of a problem, it's not going to be a good book, because it didn't cover everything. It may come out at the end that the reader is driven to take one side over the other, but at least you'll have a chance to look at both. When I write about terror in Terror Flower, for example, I must cover in the story of the terror situation in the problem, I must cover five or six different types of terrorists, including the good old boys up in the counties who had a lot of machine guns in their plaster walls. It's something where you have to look at both sides. And I think that's what I try to do with my books. I'm not saying that I would ever come out and take one side or the other, except to the end, but I think the characters tend to eventually go to that site. What do they go to the site about? Well, enslaved graves. I think they come out on the side of freedom. My second book, Magnolia Gods, I think they come out on the side of the foolishness of atomic weapons. In the third book, which you have a copy of, Parable of Racer, I think they come out on the side of what the old man says in the end about the problem of race and so forth. I think you...
So they all come out... So they all come out on the right side of some moral issue.
Well, at least what the characters say. You can't make a fake character. So if you make a character and they happen to play the part, if they're written right, they're going to say something. And, you know, I try to make them non-political, just normal, everyday people who have fought through a battle of some kind, come out at the end and said, you know, hey, this was pretty tough. But whether they come out saying something that the reader wants to hear, that's not my business. My business is to write the characters. And if I pick the right kind of people, they should come out with something that most readers will feel is accurate. I've had a lot of compliments to my books over the years. And one is someone will look up and say, Tommy, did this really happen? That's a great compliment to a writer who's making up fiction. And then another one will be, you know, you feel like you're really there. That's a compliment, too. I love those compliments far more than me.
But they're
a lot of the others.
They're compliments well worth having, Tommy. Where can our listeners get your books?
Oh, I've got them all over. Friends have helped me. And that's a tall order, too, to get books out. But... obviously, Amazon, all the ebook areas, Kobo. I work with iTunes, I guess it's called, Barnes & Noble. And close to my heart, I have two bookstores down the shore that have been very kind to me. One is, I think it's Mystery Loves Company. My friend... what's her name?
Yeah, Kathy Herrig's. That's Kathy Herrig's bookstore.
And in Easton, the Easton Books, Easton News, with my friend Dottie.
Yeah, the news center in Easton.
They're wonderful people.
They are.
A lot. Yeah. And I think Dottie told me she put one of her famous notes on my Powerboat Racer book there. Hmm. So, you know.
Well, Tommy, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for joining us today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition. As I've said, I've read two of your seven books in the River Sunday series and found them both delightful and informative. Thank you again for joining us. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll talk about the Eastern Shore Writers Association with historian Susan Jones and the new president of the association, Ron Souder. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guests for this segment of the program are historian and writer Susan Jones.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. And the new president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association, Ron Souder. Ron, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Susan, let me begin with you. What is the Eastern Shore Writers Association, and how did you come to write a history of the organization?
Well, let me start with the second question. How did I come to write the history, which I call a short, incomplete history? Essentially, I was caught with my defenses down when, in about late 2013, then-President Jerry Sweeney approached me, telling me that in 2 years, 2015 would be the 30th anniversary of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. And it's difficult to deny Jerry what he wants. And so I agreed. He gave me a very nice committee of Ann McNulty and Brent Lewis. And they worked, did a lot of interviewing and a lot of looking for me as well. And, of course, Jerry was a good source, too, because I think he knows everyone. As far as the definition, when I wrote the book, I looked around at the our materials and came up with this definition. The Eastern Shore Writers Association is a volunteer organization supporting writers, other writers' groups, and the literary arts across the Delmarva Peninsula and the Eastern Shore. We include poets, novelists, nonfiction, and short story writers, and we welcome and encourage members to share their experiences, converting ideas, feelings, hopes, dreams, and opinions to the printed word.
And so, how did you set out writing this history? What did you look for? What was your construct, Susan?
I didn't have one at first. I didn't quite know what Jerry wasn't specific as to what he wanted as the finished product. And so we met with, our committee met together and we talked about having it just be video vignettes. And we talked about what kinds of questions we would ask people, how we would find people who had been active in the history. Mostly, I think it was finding the right people to talk to and to interview. And, of course, the immediate past presidents are not hard to track down. But it's as you get back into the earlier part of its history that it's harder to piece things together. But we started out sort of a two-pronged method, not only interviewing people as we learned of names, but also just the hard work, which actually fell to me because I did it all, of looking back through newspaper articles. And unfortunately, although we have this lovely online search technique, it doesn't really apply back to 1985. So I did a lot of looking at the Talbot County Library in Easton through their microfilm.
So
collection.
1985 was the beginning?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what happened at the beginning? People just got together and said, we need to talk to each other about writing and how we write?
Not exactly. It was really the brainchild of a woman called Joan Heavey. She and Bruce Jones both taught at Chesapeake College. And they got together and decided they would like to form this monthly luncheon club. There's a wonderful description from an article in the Star Democrat, and it refers to this meeting on January 19th, 1985, at the Talbot County Library in Easton, of a group, they called it a diverse group of writers. And among those writers, there were some quite well-known writers who had published, and all the way down to a seven-year-old who had just had an article published in Cricket magazine, which I thought was sweet. But a couple of people I spoke to, including Arlene Chase, who was an early president, and Helen Chappelle, also recalled a meeting slightly prior to that that had been sponsored by the public library. It was called Have Lunch with a Published Author Luncheon. And it was at the Tidewater Inn. And as Arlene Chase told me, she went hoping to rub shoulders with some of the authors that were going to be there, published authors. And since whoever was in charge said they did not want anyone wearing name badges, it meant that it was pretty hard to identify these published authors. And so it ended up that Helen Chappelle sat at a table all by herself. And she recalled, it was so embarrassing. I sat there all alone at the table and no one came and sat with me. At any rate, it was at this meeting that Joan Heavey brought up her idea to start a monthly luncheon meeting. And so the initial meeting was set for the 19th of January, and a quite a sizable crowd showed up, I think about 20, which surprised even Joan Heavey.
Well, Susan, how did things evolve from there? I mean, you've got a luncheon meeting going on of a bunch of people who want to write and some who have written.
Mm-hmm.
What was the construct after that? What did the association do, and how did it grow?
They took care of a lot of that at that very first meeting. The group discussed ideas and goals for the new organization. They formed committees right away to nominate officers, to plan programs for monthly meetings, and to design seminars for beginners and experienced writers. And those in attendance agreed that the organization's primary goal was going to be to serve as an intellectual and social forum for writers and to discuss individual writing projects and exchange ideas and information.
So the lunches were one of the first activities, one of the main activities. And then I understand the... when did the writers' conference idea come up, and when did the literary journal idea come up as the association evolved?
Well, to start with the second, the first writing project started very soon. It was 1987 when the first publication came out, the Shore Writers Sampler. So that was a very early on interest, and they put out two of those in the first 87 and 88. Then there was a lapse, and then the first Delmarva Review made its appearance. But there was a gap in between there. So they were very committed to writing, highlighting.
To publishing each other's work.
Right, although the first two, the two Shore Writers samplers were not restricted to ESWA members. In fact, they had a system in place where they obscured the name of those submitting articles so that the judges would not know whether they were members or not. They invited people from all over the peninsula to submit, but they didn't want to judge based on whether they were members or not. Whereas the second go-around with publishing, which was Michael Blaine's, he was the editor for, I think, six issues, or there were five issues over 6 years, I believe, of the Delmarva Review. That was to give members an outlet for their writing.
And now I understand we're issue 9 is out, and we're working on issue 10, I understand.
But you're better at that than I am because you're hands-on.
Yeah, so. I'm a little bit your host is a little bit involved here. But early on, for the Delmarva Review anyway, it was some writers in the more immediate area on the Delmarva. Now it's just open
right
to the world, as it were. How about the Beta Ocean Writers Conference? See, that would be, I kind of think of these as three things: the lunches, the Beta Ocean Writers Conference, and the Delmarva Review. When did the Beta Ocean Writers Conference get started?
Well, as far as ESWA's involvement with it, that was not until 2009. But what is called the first one was way back in 1998. But at first it was Avalon Partnership, and then the public library took over. And it wasn't until 2009 that it became ESWA's baby. But the interesting thing was that many of the people hands-on, like Diane Marquette, it sort of morphed very easily because they had already been very involved,
right,
even when it wasn't ESWA's child.
Right. And I understand the Beta Ocean Writers Conference is coming up now next month. Actually, fairly.
That's right.
Soon.
I keep thinking of it as being a February thing, but as of last year, it's a March thing.
And there are about 200 people who attend the conference. Well, Susan, you worked on this history of the Eastern Shore Writers Association, which you referred to as ESWA. And many of us do refer to the Writers mm-hmm. Association as ESWA. And I wanted to ask you in this history, what surprised you most about the organization as you delved into its past?
Well, several things. One is just the paradox of how short a time and how long a time 30 years can be.
Well, that some of speaking us have found that to be the case. I'll tell you.
Yeah, speaking as someone who can't remember what she did yesterday, I can. It's not hard to understand at all. But when I would speak to people who had been president at a certain time, and you said, "Well, I'm having a problem with who was president the year before that?" Well, I can't remember. Who was president after you? Well, I can't remember.
Well, when I read your history, and as I look at the Eastern Shore Writers Association, one of the things that has surprised me looking, if I can add in here, surprised me looking at this history, is the vitality of the writing community in this small area of the Eastern Shore of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. It seems as though everybody is a writer, and almost everybody has published something as well. So they're good writers.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, so it's a it's a very vibrant writing community, I think, and ESWA appears to me, anyway, to serve it well. What did you find, Susan, the most interesting compiling this little history?
Well, one of the most interesting things was just you referred to a vibrant community. Well, I found that the enthusiasm and the commitment of those people who had been directly hands-on involved in the Eastern Shore Writers Association was very amazing and uplifting. They were very committed. And when they were president, they were so interested in finding good speakers, in looking for other things for the organization to do. Early on, of course, they partnered with, is it Dell Tech, I think, and I suppose you could call that almost a precursor of the BTO in a way, but it just didn't continue.
Susan, you've written this history, but you write other things. As well. What are you writing these days yourself?
Well, I'm always on the lookout for amusing, interesting, unusual words, and they seem to find me too. So when I encounter such a word, first of all, I think of all the ways that I can permute it and combine it and play with it. But I also look at how other people have used the word, whether in literature or news articles, and I look for it in other quotations. But the end result is that I sort of encapsulate it or lionize it or poeticize it in light verse.
Oh, so it's light verse you write.
I write light verse, which I call vocabulary verse.
Yeah.
Verse with a purpose.
Well, let me turn to you now, Ron. You're Ron Souder. You're the new president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. We've got a little bit of the history here. What do you see going forward?
Well, I guess a little of the old and a little of the new. Susan talked about the beginnings in terms of a luncheon, a Saturday luncheon, and we have, beginning this past Saturday, returned to that schedule. I find that what a lot of people want from ESWA is social connection. So there's a human personal element as well as a professional networking element. And so that's a little bit of the old. A little bit of the new, we're going to be using technology in different ways. We've done a member survey, and one of the themes that has come through is the theme of geographic distance. ESWA has about 200 members, and they're really spread in multiple states. Most of our members are on the Eastern Shore, but many are across the bay, the Western Shore. Some are in other states entirely. And even folks who live in Lewis, Delaware, or Rehoboth, Donfew, Easton, or Cambridge, or even Salisbury, as an easy drive or a comfortable distance for a gathering. So we are going to be trying some webinars. We're going to be making use of the technology of meetup.com to try to put together local communities sort of on the fly, as it were, and hope that that begins developing a continuum of membership.
Well, that really sounds very interesting, and I'll be actually excited to see how that works out, because we as a writer, you always like to talk to other writers and see what's going on out there. Another one of the olds is, we talked, Susan, about the Beta Ocean Writers Conference, and you've got the Beta Ocean Writers Conference, which is, I think, a quite significant event for the area coming up next month. I think it's
March 11th.
It's on the 11th of March. Where is it, Ron? Tell us a little bit more about it, if you would.
Sure. It's at Chesapeake College. It's one day. People who have been to national conferences would tell you that what is unique and fun about the Beta Ocean Conference is its human scale and intimacy. It tends to be one of the primary means of introduction to the Eastern Shore Writers Association. Many members have come in because of BTO, and many people come back once they try it first. So range of courses, range of speakers, a mixture of familiar faculty and new faculty, and we have a tremendous committee that works on putting this event together every year.
So it's basically how-to stuff, if I understand correctly.
Education.
Craft.
Inspiration.
And techniques.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Everything from how to blog and promote your work with social media to how to construct story and how to craft poetry, introduction to magazines, a chance to meet editors, chance to learn from experienced speakers. We do have room. As I speak, it's close to 4 weeks away. There are still places available. It does usually sell out.
I do understand that it sells out fairly quickly, and I'm somewhat surprised to hear that there's room. So those of you out there who've been thinking about going to the Bay Ocean Writers Conference, go on the website. Is that how you sign up, Ron?
It's on their website. It's linked through the EasternShoreWriters.org, which is our sort of umbrella website.
And you sign up.
Yes.
For the conference there. How does one go about joining ESWA, Ron?
Same thing. There's a membership application. We tend to like people who like us. There's not a rigorous screening protocol. If you want to join with other writers, it doesn't matter whether you're interested in flash fiction, podcasts, poetry, essays, novels, short stories. We have people who consider themselves journalists and editors. We have people who have never published a single piece of writing but want to learn from people who have. So we welcome anyone who's interested in joining.
Well, I encourage anyone who has not attended the Bay Ocean Writers Conference that you consider signing up for this year, since there is a little bit of room available. Get in there before it fills, because 200 is the limit, as I understand.
I think that's right. I'm not on the committee myself, but I watch how hard they work, and it is worth doing.
Ron, in addition to being the new president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association, you are a publisher as well, and you have a publishing company that I believe you own and operate called Secant. Is that
Secant Publishing?
Secant Publishing. Well, Susan will know. We writers are always interested in publishers, and so let me ask you a little bit about your publishing company. What are you doing? And I understand you have published a couple of books of Eastern Shore Writer Association writers.
Quite a few. I was very pleased to find that the goals and mission of ESWA seemed to me to be pretty similar to my own personal goals.
Well, how did you get into the publishing business? What's going on here?
I've been a word guy my whole life, beginning really as a high school newspaper stringer, and as so many of us started out years ago. Spent most of my life in university communications, and when I came here as a trailing spouse in 2013, looked around for something to do and gravitated toward publishing. I love books. I love to read. I love to publish books. And was very gratified quickly out of the box to be able to find an overlooked manuscript by William Peake, whom you know.
Bill, yeah.
Bill Peake. Bill's debut novel, first novel he published, first novel I published, The Oblate's Confession, has won multiple national awards, and including being named to the Kirkus Review's Best Indie Books list of 2015. That was...
So you've got a good eye. As a publisher.
Lucky, maybe. Lucky to end up in the right place and meet some of the right people. And sort of to compound the joy, the following year, Bill's colleague at the Talbot County Free Library, Karen Carides, whose book I had also published, Hard-Boiled Anxiety, was also named to the Kirkus Review's Best Indie Books of 2016. So I'm afraid to hold my breath in 2017, but that's been a wonderful way to be able to
start.
Well,
our consistent listeners will recognize the Hard-Boiled Anxiety. We interviewed Karen on the program last month and talked about her book that you published.
And yeah. I've published other ESWA members as well, Barbara Lockhart and Ann Himes, and a number of other Eastern Shore writers, Helen Chappell, Hal Roth, Gilbert Byron, published posthumously.
Well, what kind of books do you look for at your company?
My thought when I moved here was to be able to sort of extend and honor and celebrate the literary heritage of the Eastern Shore. There's something about the Eastern Shore, and probably has to do with its relative remoteness over most of the years of its European settlement, that have made it a place for eccentrics, people with an angular vision, people maybe with not a lot else to do than write. I've been told that when you retire to the Eastern Shore, you need to either sail, paint, or write. And maybe that's one way we get writers. So that was my vision. I've ended up publishing books that are sort of set outside of the Eastern Shore as well. But I'm always on the lookout for a strong voice, a strong sense of story. And my hope is always to find a book set on the Eastern Shore with those qualities.
Well, how does a writer introduce their book to you, Ron? How does the foot get in the door, as it were?
I get email every day. So just send it to editor@secantpublishing.com. Or look on my website, secantpublishing.com. And I'll be happy to talk to any aspiring author.
Do you read, manuscripts that come in the mail, do you? Or is the introduction by email?
If I like what I hear from someone, I will ask them to see a manuscript. So we'll take it from there.
And then how does the writer work with you? What happens if you take their manuscript? What do you do?
Well, I work with writers in a variety of ways. I learned years ago that when you're beginning in a publishing relationship with someone, the most important thing to do is to understand what they want from their book. And different people actually want different things. If someone wants to become a national bestseller, I'm probably not the right publisher for them. I hope that someday I will publish a national bestseller, but it's hard. And as you know, the Big Five in New York, followed by the large university presses, have such a leg up and national distribution and sales. But if someone wants to publish an excellent book that's well-made, well-edited, well-designed, and has a realistic sense of the role that they're going to play as an author in helping to promote the book after it's published, then I'm happy to talk to them because I think I can help them. I think that there are things that I can do for them in terms of national distribution and certain kinds of national marketing. And I can also advise them in certain ways about things they can do to help themselves.
Well, Ron, it sounds as though as a publisher, you're an excellent asset for the writers here on the shore. And we're looking forward to your year at ESWA as president as well, and see the organization continue to grow under your leadership.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Susan, for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
On Delmarva Today Writers Edition. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.